The final matter on the this panel's calendar, oral calendar this morning, Cannon Falls Mall, Inc. versus State of Minnesota and through its Commissioner of Transportation. Our file number is A190475. Good morning.
Good morning.
And as you're aware, each party will be allowed 15 minutes. And is one council, I see with two council, did you, one council will be responding?
Your Honor, I'm Gary Van Cleve, and I'll be the only one arguing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good, thank you. And so, appellant's counsel, when you're ready, you may approach the podium. Please identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Jeff Thompson on behalf of the state of Minnesota by its Commissioner of Transportation. This is a inverse condemnation case where the Cannon Falls Mall brought a suit seeking an order, a mandamus order from the district court requiring the state to initiate condemnation proceedings to acquire access rights from the mall based on the allegation that changes made to the road system as a result of a highway project took their right of reasonable, convenient, and suitable access.
I just want to make sure that I understand your argument. And on the one hand, you seem to be arguing that the district court erred because it should have granted summary judgment to you. And on the other hand, you're saying there were disputed facts. Am I wrong in reading your brief that way?
No, Your Honor, you're correct. There are two different elements. One element is whether there's a denial of reasonably convenient and suitable access, and the other is whether there are definite and measurable damages. The evidence as to definite measurable damages that the court ultimately considered, those are disputed facts as to whether or not there's even a diminution in value or if it was caused by the highway project as opposed to the collapsing mall industry. As to reasonably convenient and suitable access, we take the position that at the very least there's a dispute of fact, but the evidence that was produced to contra to the state's evidence, this evidence that was produced along with the reply memo 3 days before the summary judgment hearing, despite the fact that it had been requested in discovery. And that evidence, in addition to not being available for use under the rules of discovery, under 3703, a party isn't allowed to use that which it doesn't produce in discovery.
So if I understand your position correctly, you're not saying that our disposition of the appeal necessarily resolves all issues in favor of one or the other party, but there is a possibility of a partial victory for the state where a remand would be appropriate to decide some issues.
No, Your Honor. At the very least, remand is necessary, but I think if the court focuses only on that evidence which is admissible in eminent domain cases and available under the rules of discovery, the state should win as to the first element, and because they're elements, the state winning on either element is requires denial of the petition for a writ of mandamus as a matter of law.
Can I just clarify, because I think maybe it was a yes instead of a no, if I understood the question is, so the state is arguing as part of its position today that there are no genuine issues of material fact, but that there was a reasonably convenient alternative, and hence the court should order that the error was not granting the state summary judgment on that first issue.
Your Honor, if the court does not consider the evidence submitted at the 11th hour on the eve of the hearing that wasn't produced in discovery and doesn't consider the evidence that eminent domain rules don't allow to be considered for valuation purposes, if that evidence is removed, then the state, then the court should grant as a matter of law summary judgment to the state. If that evidence is considered, then we do have material fact disputes that require remand.
Was the trial court asked? Go ahead.
No, that answers my question. So you're saying there is a logical possibility of a remand?
Yes, Your Honor. Right. If that evidence is considered.
No, I understand.
Right. Sorry, I think that answered my question as well. Thank you.
Now, the district court, as to the first element, whether or not there's a denial of reasonably convenient and suitable access, the district court erred in two ways. One way it erred is in the evidence it considered, and secondly, it erred in its application of Minnesota law. The court did not engage in the analysis required by the Hendrickson decision. The Hendrickson decision is the seminal access case from 1964, which requires the court to evaluate whether the access route available after the project that causes the change, whether the route available or any route available is reasonably convenient and suitable. The district court did not engage in that analysis. The uncontroverted evidence shows that the average trip to the site for northbound traffic, it's 6 seconds longer to get to the mall. It's 6 seconds longer. To get back from the mall onto northbound 52, it takes an additional 30 seconds. So we have 36 seconds added to the northbound trip, on and off the highway. For southbound 52, the access, the additional time is even less. It's it's 12 seconds to get into the property longer, and it's 6 seconds to get back onto Highway 52 longer, for a total of 18 seconds. So we're looking at a total additional time for southbound motorists of 18 seconds and for northbound motorists of 36 seconds.
And yet we have Mr. Reimer, I think that's how you pronounce it, his affidavit that said that drivers on through Highway 52 need to drive 3 miles round trip, 1.5 miles to arrive at the mall, and 1.5 miles to return. So that seems like that's longer than either 6 or 30 seconds.
What he's doing is putting himself on the highway at the point of closure and then doubling back, as opposed to taking the alternate route that's available. Under Hendrickson, we look at the alternate route that's available. We don't put ourselves at the point of closure and then have to do a U-turn, come back, and try again. And a good example of that is in this court's decision in CNR Stacy. In that case, the county barricaded the 25-foot opening onto County Road 19, and it was remanded by this court because the district court did not engage in the necessary Hendrickson analysis as to whether or not a different route that adds a four-block detour was reasonably convenient and suitable. They didn't require the analysis to be, we're now at this closure, we have to go all the way over the interstate bridge, do a U-turn, come back, and then go, and then take the four-block, go past the property to the intersection, and then do the four-block detour. We're just looking at the four-block detour. We get to assume that the motorists have some sense.
Mr. Thompson, your answer to that question suggests that would be your cross-examination of the expert, in other words, for Cannon Falls. Is your point that's the judge erred in weighing the evidence in terms of the 6 seconds versus his opinion, and hence that's the reason summary judgment was improper?
Yes, Your Honor. Once the court, two things. The court didn't actually weigh the evidence. It's not analyzed at all. There's nowhere in the decision does the court analyze the after route and find that it is unsuitable. What we don't know for the mall, and it was asked in discovery, how many customers actually come from the highway? This is a hardware store. How many customers are passerbys on a highway? There's a Chinese restaurant in there. There's a 24-hour fitness or Snap Fitness. Are these impulse buyers from the highway? Are these just customers that are coming from within Cannon Falls? They don't know. We can't understand the impact of the closure of an intersection unless we know how many of the customers are actually using the intersection. They have no idea. And so without that information, there's no way to know the impact. Because, and let's just hypothetically, if 10% of the customers are coming from the south on northbound 52, we don't assume a loss of 10% of their business. We assume they're going to lose whatever customers are so off-put by the extra 6 seconds to get there that they're going to stop doing business there and they're going to drive to Invergrove Heights to buy their hammer or their plunger or whatever they're going to buy at the hardware store. Or I'm trying to think where the nearest Chinese restaurant is north on 52, probably Invergrove Heights too, right? So you have to assume that of that 10% of their customer base that can't make that the old turn, how many are going to make the new turn and how many aren't? None of that information is known. And if it was known, it wasn't provided. And in the absence of that information, the district court can't reach the decision that it reached. But at the very least, it rejected the state's evidence or at least they didn't even consider the state's evidence. We don't know how it rejected. We don't know the basis for the rejection, but it's if, in fact, that extra 6 seconds to get to the property matters, we don't know why the district court thinks that it does. And there isn't any evidence in the record other than the conclusory statement of Mr. Reimer that it does matter. And we don't know if the business difficulties at the mall are the product of the project or the product of the collapsing mall industry. You know, and one way we could have been able to tell is if they had produced in discovery their business records. If they're crashing and plummeting for years and years before the project, and that same rate of collapse continues through the project, is a pretty strong inference that it's not the project that caused their problems. That was never produced, so we don't know.
Mr. Thompson, the court made findings regarding the 1963 easement that was retained, and the 1978, it looks like, regarding the creation of this public right-of-way, the subsequent owners. Was there an argument made, and what relevance do you believe there is, if at all, regarding the 1963 or 78, the relevance of that in the issue of the writ that's requested?
The access opening that was, the right of access that was retained is what allows them to even get to court to ask for the writ. If all rights of access as an abutter had already been acquired, there would be nothing for the state to take. A district court couldn't order the state to take access rights to this property if they no longer existed. So that gets us in front of the judge, but that's all it does is gets us in front of the judge, where we then apply the Hendrickson test. There really is no difference between the reserved right of access via County Road 24 in this case, or the 25.83 linear foot opening in CNR Stacy, or the route through Florida Avenue in Grossman. In the end, we always just apply the Hendrickson analysis. Those just establish that the right existed. And then we apply the Hendrickson analysis, and we look as, is the route that remains reasonably convenient and suitable? Not did what they have, was that super great? It's a binary test. It's a pass-fail test. And as long as you're still passing afterwards, a writ of mandamus cannot issue. And so using the pass-fail rubric, if you have A-plus access before, and you go down to D-minus, if that's still a passing grade, there is no taking, even though there is a substantial shift in the level of convenience. And as the court said in Hendrickson and in Johnson versus City of Plymouth, even substantial inconvenience is not tantamount to a taking of the right of access.
Complain may be too strong of a word, but you certainly comment on how you had sought detailed financial information from Ken Balls Mall and you didn't get it. And I was curious about the footnote in their brief that they say that they objected to this discovery in the mandamus proceeding as being premature, among other reasons, and that you never challenged that objection or sought a motion to compel.
Yeah. Under the rules of discovery, a litigant has two options when an evidence isn't produced. One is a motion to compel, and the other is to rely on Rule 3703 to know that it's not coming in. Personally, as a litigator, when they don't give me anything, that means they don't have anything to use as long as the rules are strictly enforced. And so why would I force them to make a case that they're not doing when they bear their burden of proof, when they're not doing it themselves? Now, when all of that information that they say is premature is what the district court relied on, and they produced 3 days before the hearing, and they produced conclusory statements, none of the underlying data, so we still don't know. But if it was premature, then they shouldn't have used it in this case. And they used it in this case, and that's what the district court relied on. So ultimately, the state has the same rights as any litigator, and that's to choose between the motion to compel or the 3703 denial of use of that information. And the exception to the 3703 is substantially justified. There's no effort to prove, and the burden is on the party that didn't produce to show that it was their failure to produce was not substantially justified. No effort was made here to show why they failed to produce that or why it was substantially justified. And the fact that it's the cornerstone of the district court's decision shows that it wasn't premature. It ends up being very important in this case, and improperly, because they're still supposed to analyze the after route. But it ends up being the basis of the decision, so it's incredibly important. But there's no affirmative duty to seek the motion to compel in every case.
The right of, or the availability of reasonable access, reasonably suitable access, is generally a question of fact. Is it ever so clear that it's a question of law?
It can be. There's a footnote in Hendrickson where the court, and Hendrickson is a remand. Hendrickson isn't, there are some decisions where Hendrickson is found as a case finding a denial of access. Hendrickson is a remand for that fact analysis. And it's remanded because there's questions as to the final location of some of the crossovers between the frontage road and the highway. And there's a footnote that says, if we knew that the current locations, the current temporary locations were permanent, we'd have no problem finding that there isn't a taking as a matter of law. So there is that availability for that finding in Hendrickson as a matter of law. And I see my time is out, and I've talked to you on rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Excuse me. May it please the court, Gary Van Cleve. With me today is Rob Stefanowitz on behalf of Cannon Falls Mall, Inc. One of the remarkable declarations from MnDOT in its argument this morning is that you have to completely ignore what the access was in the before. That is the entire essence of looking at whether or not there has been a loss of reasonably convenient and suitable access. Their stopwatch analyst ignored what was present in the before. And what was present in the before is that one of the 27,000 vehicles that travels along Trunk Highway 52 every day through what used to be that intersection, whether they were going north or south, it was a simple matter of them going to that stoplight and either turning right to get into onto County Road 24 and up 64th Avenue Path, or if they were coming from the north, they would turn left at the stoplight and then go up 64th Avenue Path. 64th Avenue Path originated as an easement that was secured by the original developer of Cannon Falls Mall, because that developer knew how important it was to be able to make it convenient for the traveling public. And let's make no mistake about it, they might want to call this a regional mall in their brief, which is an absurd proposition. It's not Maplewood Mall, it's not Rosedale, it's not Southdale, it's not Eden Prairie Center. This is a small shopping center, which happens to have an interior common area, so that's what makes it a mall. It does have an interior common area, but there are 14 stores, or were 14 stores in there before the taking of the access, and there are half a dozen left now, not to mention the rent concessions that had to be given in order to keep some of those tenants in place. So you have to consider what that access was in the before and the history of that access.
Why doesn't that, the presentation that you just made, demonstrate that we're talking about a factual inquiry that a fact finder has to determine as opposed to a summary judgment determination as a matter of law?
Well, let's go back to the trial court and what happened there. This was presented to the trial court judge on cross motions for summary judgment. MnDOT did not dispute any of the facts we put into the record. And I am, frankly, somewhat mystified by the statements and arguments this morning that we somehow sprung evidence on them at the 11th hour during the summary judgment motion that they claimed to have asked for during discovery. Yes, we objected to it. And as far as the claim that we had to be substantially justified in not producing it, we stated in our objections, this is a mandamus proceeding. This is not an eminent domain proceeding. And I think that ultimately what is going on here is that I think that MnDOT is conflating the eminent domain proceeding and the determination of just compensation with the threshold and preliminary determination of whether or not there's been a taking. The question of a taking is a question of law. And in answer to your question, Judge Ross, it is absolutely the case that that can be done, and it frequently is done, on cross motions for summary judgment. As in this case, we proceeded the same way that we have in other inverse condemnation cases that we have litigated. We submitted our facts to the judge, and we said there was a loss of reasonably convenient and suitable access. The judge agreed with us. There is no support, as they have been arguing very aggressively in this case, for a stopwatch test for determining whether or not you still have convenient and suitable access in the after. The test under Hedrickson, which is the seminal case, is the circuity of that access in the after. And if that access is circuitous, then it and it is difficult for a traveler to get to that site. If it's not readily apparent to them, then that can create a loss of reasonably convenient and suitable access. And I think that
can you address the question that I asked earlier before you got to the podium, which is, at what point do we have the line between reasonably suitable access being a question of fact and it being a question of law that the district court can determine?
I would point you, Judge Ross, to not only the Hendrickson case, but a case that MnDOT steadfastly ignores. They don't even cite it in either one of their briefs, and that is the subsequent case of Thompson v. Head. And Thompson v. Head clarified what they said was a confusion generated by Hendrickson that led some litigants and courts to believe that you had to impanel a jury to determine whether or not there was a taking. What Thompson said is that in most cases, no, that is not the case. There will not be disputed facts, and it's a determination as a matter of law by the court whether or not there is a deprivation of reasonably convenient and suitable access.
Mr. Van Cleve, the question is the court's order, and even the example, the stopwatch approach, I believe that you referenced, would not it be for this reviewing court a requirement to review a judge's analysis of that and why there are no genuine issues of material fact despite this competing evidence, so we could analyze how the court came to that conclusion?
Well, the judge, in fairness to the trial judge, both lawyers stood before him and said, there are no disputed issues of fact in this case. And I think that the fact that the judge didn't comment on this stopwatch theory, there are many cases that say that when a trial court issues its findings, if it doesn't comment on it, then the presumption is they rejected it. They did not think that that was a finding that created a genuine issue of material fact. And I do want to call the court's attention to what MnDOT itself, how it described in its initial brief how you have to get to Cannon Falls Mall after they shut down this intersection. MnDOT said, at the conclusion of the project, County State Aid Highway 4 followed the 4th Street roadway south into the north entrance of the easternmost roundabout of the interchange, continued westward through the other eastern roundabout, continued across the bridge over Trunk Highway 52, continued westward through two western roundabouts, continued westward on newly created right-of-way, and eventually reconnected with its prior alignment and continued southwesterly until it intersects with County Highway 9. That is MnDOT's description of what you've got to negotiate as the traveling public in order to get to Cannon Falls Mall. And as Judge Riley, as you pointed out, the property owner said, the problem is people lose sight of the property when they are going by and when they are trying to find it in the after situation. I would also point out that there were two outlots that abut Highway 52, and this property sits up on a hill, and you come down the hill to where the intersection used to be. And so they're prominently situated outlots that would have been prime highway-oriented business development property. And the fact of the matter is that since they shut down that intersection, nobody's been interested in acquiring that property or developing anything there, because that is the purpose of those outlots at a shopping center, is to provide some sort of a convenience business. And the loss of that access underscores again and the loss, the inability to sell those outlots underscores again how damaging it was for the property owner here. The trial court also pointed out that there were three other property owners at the same intersection who, just like Cannon Falls Mall, MnDOT refused to acknowledge had lost any compensable property right. But when they were forced to get lawyers and made demands on MnDOT, MnDOT did not challenge that they had lost reasonably convenient and suitable access. And they're talking about the same access in this case as all those property owners were left with. The same stopwatch analysis would presumably apply to them. But what they did is, when they were called on it, they sat down and they negotiated settlements of the amount of just compensation. These arguments that they're making in this case is an attempt to bootstrap the types of disputes and arguments we have in eminent domain cases on the issue of just compensation all the time. They want to impose a greater burden on the property owner who's already forced to have to affirmatively bring an inverse condemnation action because they were ignored by the governmental authority on some public project, and the pleas of that property owner to say, look, you know, you really did take a property interest of ours. And what MnDOT wants to say is that you've pretty much got to go out and get an appraisal and show with specificity what your damages are at the mandamus phase. That is not the law. What Hendrickson says, what Johnson Brothers says, which is the case that was relied on very heavily by the trial court here, is that any diminution in market value of the property caused by substantial impairment of the right to reasonably convenient and suitable access to the main thoroughfare in at least one direction is a deprivation of property for which compensation must be paid. Any diminution in value. You're not fighting over what the amount is. They can say that it's de minimis or maybe even zero, but that's for the eminent domain proceeding. That is not something that the property owner is forced to have to show and prove in the mandamus proceeding. This question is simply whether or not there was a taking.
Mr. Van Cleve, I noticed that finding 7, the court made, plaintiff's property value has been significantly diminished as a result of the access closure. So I'm assuming by what you just commented first that you believe the court was making reference to the mandamus phase, not a specific amount, but it does appear as if there was evidence. It doesn't outline what competing evidence there was, but so I assume from that your client submitted specific evidence related to the significant loss in value as a result of the closure?
Yes, Your Honor. There was quite a bit of evidence. The property owner, there was a verified complaint, and then there were two separate declarations by the property owner in the summary judgment record, where the property owner attested to having received a $1.9 million offer from a potential buyer to buy the property when it had access. And the property owner, and this is admissible evidence, a property owner's own opinion of the value of that property owner's property, attested that he thought it was worth between $1.8 and $1.9 million before the taking of the access. MnDOT itself, they claimed they didn't get any discovery. We gave them appraisals that had been done on the property previously, not in connection with this taking, but appraisals that the property owner had done for various reasons, financing. There was a 2012 appraisal that MnDOT put in the record that put the value of the property at $1.82 million. Also, there was evidence in the summary judgment record showing that The property tax assessor had reduced the value for pay 2019 to $849 million from a little over $1 million. So the property had declined precipitously in value since the closing of the intersection. There was also evidence that the property owner had received offers essentially to pay off the mortgage debt, which was around $600,000 or $700,000, in the after. That's what a willing buyer was willing to offer him to buy Cannon Falls Mall without that access. There was evidence that showed that the property owner, Mr. Reimer, had been trying to sell those outlots and had been unable to sell them, which again were well situated had that access been there for some kind of highway-oriented business. And there was evidence that Mr. Reimer has been actively trying to sell the property through a broker since the closure of the intersection, and that those attempts have been uniformly unsuccessful. So I think it's important for the court to separate out the issue, the narrow issue of the inverse condemnation mandamus question before the court of whether or not there's been a taking, and the issues that will come up in the eminent domain proceeding, which Mr. Thompson is going to be have full latitude to explore concerning what the amount of damages was as a result of that taking. I see my time is up, but we would respectfully request the court to affirm the ruling of the trial court and to remand this for commencement of eminent domain proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thompson, you may respond if you wish.
Thank you. Let me address the concerns over the stopwatch approach.
Before you get there, yes. Can you, your reply brief doesn't address Thompson v. Head, yes. And its clarification of Hendrickson. Can you address that now?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you continue reading beyond the block quote supplied by respondent, about two paragraphs later, the Supreme Court in Thompson says, it is only when the facts are disputed that the mandamus court should utilize a jury to resolve the disputes preparatory to its decision on the ultimate question of law. So when there are disputed facts, then we use the jury. And here we have disputed facts. The state put in evidence that there was no diminution in value, and that if there was any diminution in value, it was the product of the collapsing mall market. In fact, the estimate is that by 2022, a quarter of them will be out of business. And so to point to diminishing rental returns and say, see, it's the project cause, that's just the post hoc fallacy. We need actual evidence to show some sort of causation. You can't just say because it happened afterwards, it's naturally and automatically the result of. That evidence of the offers, the first time any of those numbers were presented was with the declaration that was submitted 3 days before the summary judgment hearing, never in response to discovery. And so again, that's that improper evidence under 3703. As to the stopwatch theory, and that's counsel's label for the state following the methodology used in the Grossman decision. And in the Grossman decision, this court looked at the difference in time and said going from seconds to minutes isn't a taking. So the notion of convenience is, in essence, a notion of time, of it's temporal. And so to use a stopwatch seems altogether proper and certainly is one avenue of dispute and would require weighing to reject it and improper weighing at summary judgment. But if we look at circuity, In the before, as described by counsel, it's two turns off of Highway 52 to get to the mall. In the after, it's three, which is the same as Grossman. Grossman went from two turns to three as well. So when we look at Grossman, if we're looking at it for stopwatch or for number of turns, again, and there was no taking in Grossman, we have the same thing here. Going from two turns to three turns isn't so so confusing for motorists that they're not going to be able to find it. And for a court to find that, it's going to require some very specific findings, and it would be contrary to the state's facts asserted at summary judgment, so it would require a trial to resolve whether or not three turns is too much. What do motorists need in terms of sight? There's no record evidence that talking about the benefits of visual contact. And, of course, decisions that were written decades ago before the advent of everybody's cell phones telling them exactly how to make the turns and to find the places well in advance shift the analysis significantly, and the court has no mention of losing sight or any of that information. It wasn't analyzed, but if it was analyzed, it would require weighing, and the only way to get to the result is if the court weighed disputed evidence. We heard a description of the route that County Road 24 takes after the project. That's not the route on and off of Highway 52. The subject property abuts Highway 52 and County Road 24. Highway 52 is the property's western boundary, and County Road 24 is the property's, at the time of MnDOT's project, was the eastern boundary. And County Road 24 ran along the east side of 52, crossed 52, and then went to near the town of Denison, 9 miles away. It had that same route.
I think 52 is going north and south.
Yes.
And as I visualize 24, it's going east and west.
24 goes east and west as it crosses the highway.
Right.
And then it diagonals southwesterly. Actually, it's south-southwesterly, 9 miles to Denison, you know, out into the country where it stops. 24 in the before and during this case ran along and parallel to 52 up into downtown Cannon Falls. And 24 is on 4th Street. 4th Street was Highway 52 until the 1963 transaction where MnDOT bought the land from the predecessor owner. The current alignment of 52 is the bypass that was built in the 60s. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thank you to all counsel, and appreciate your comments as well as your briefing. We will issue a ruling. Have a good day.
Thank you. You're welcome.